I've at times wanted to or just tried to casually meditate in a kind of casual posture. And I've never had much success like that. Maybe it's a shortcoming of mine, but I find that unless I kind of get into a really upright, pretty solid posture, my mind doesn't seem to really want to go there. My mind doesn't really want to go there anyway. So it might be purely conditioning. It might just be that, for so many years I've practiced like that, that if I'm not in that kind of posture, I'm just conditioned. I don't know. But as usual, I will encourage you to get into a what I will call a meditative posture, which to me means upright. If you are able to manage being upright, there are people who simply cannot sit in that kind of posture and then can meditate lying down, but into a posture that you can be very stable and still. And then close your eyes or just lower your gaze so that you are withdrawing from the visual world. And this can help you to turn your attention inward. Can also, I think, trigger more thinking as the mind looks for stimulation or just becomes busier. So closing our eyes doesn't necessarily quiet as much. We have to deal with that. That, of course, is one of the challenges of meditation, is to deal with the busyness of the mind. And so one of the ways to counteract that busyness is to be very intentional about feeling the sensations in the body. One thing we can do is begin our sit with a fairly quick sweeping of the attention through the body, beginning with the head, or you can begin with the feet. I usually begin with the head. Relaxing your face, your jaw, your eyes. But equally important to the relaxing is just feeling awareness of the sensations. So the sensations in your face and all around your head. Just to explore that a little bit. And moving the attention down the shoulders, release the shoulders. And feel the sensations of arms and hands. Breathing into the belly, softening the belly, feeling the sensations around chest, belly, and then the back of the torso as well, the back. Feeling that central part of the body. And letting the attention move down then through the legs and feet. Now blending this just mindful attention with a gentle effort to relax, settle. Not a striving, but just a kind of allowing. And then see if you can feel your whole body as a single object rather than these individual parts. What does that feel like? What is the mind state that this is being experienced through? And to a great extent, our experience of our body and really our experience of the world is filtered through this present moment attitude. That can include an emotional state, or point of view, or insight. Might be the things that are particularly interesting you right now, so that your felt experience actually reflects your mental experience, your mental attitude. And then arriving at the breath, just settling back with the breath. As the mind wanders, we gently bring it back. Trying to maintain a certain connection to the body, to the breath, to the present moment. All right. I'm going to get into the finally move on from step nine. Whew, been a long time. I think we spent more time on step nine than any other step, and just because of the promises. I just was, you know, thinking as we were sitting about, this is not about a step, but about how there's this tendency, at least it's something I noticed in myself, that of feeling that in any given moment or day or situation that I've kind of arrived somewhere and I need to make decisions from there, particularly from the mental state that I'm in. And it makes for this very sort of erratic path through life because it kind of depends on your mood and and the immediate circumstances and situations that led up to where you are. And that seems very typical. It certainly reminds me of my time as an active addict, of just kind of not having any clear direction or through line to my life, but always kind of just like responding to what that felt like at this time, like I need to quit this, or I need to move, or whatever, just sort of making these sort of impulsive decisions. And how, you know, both recovery and Buddhism like suggest that, you know, you need to have like a direction, a clear intention that's not buffeted so much by those changing moods and mind states. I think that, which actually is relevant to the beginning of the last three steps, because they are really about setting that path and establishing that path as something relatively stable and consistent in our life. And I do think that shift in approach to life is one of the things that really changes. It certainly is one of the things that really changed how my life unfolded, being guided by principles rather than impulses. Just a thought. So, just looking out at who is here, most of you, there's a few names that I don't immediately recognize, but most of you are people I've known for a while, or have been with this class for a while. And so that's nice. It makes it a lot easier for me to just be myself here. and so I don't have to, I will. Say what I usually say, which is that we've been working through my book, One Breath at a Time, Buddhism and the 12 Steps. This is the newer cover that was created when the original publisher, Rodale, was taken over by the, larger organization. What's it called? Can't remember. Harper, whatever, something. No, Random House, something. Somebody owns me. But this was redone in 2017, and we added a foreword too at that time by Bill Alexander. And I also added an afterword. So if you have the older version, you're missing out and you have to buy it again. anyway. So I've been, you know, and I decided to do this back in March of 2020, when the first night when I did a Zoom class was March 13th, which is a Friday, which maybe should have told us something, you know, if we're superstitious. And I felt a little bit adrift, or a little sort of like, how do I do this? You know, I had worked on Zoom, but I had not done regular Dharma classes on Zoom. And I had committed right then to teach twice a week, at least as long as people needed online teaching. And I thought, oh God, I'm going to have to come up with something to teach every time. And that's going to be a lot of work. And I don't like work. So how can I make this easy for myself? One of my goals in life. I ask every day, how can I make this easy for myself? I think we should all be asking that of ourselves. How can we make life easy for ourselves? Why do we make it harder than it? Anyway? So then I guess over that weekend, I realized, oh, I could use one of my books. I'll use One Breath at a Time, and then I'll just use that as a jumping off point and read parts of it. And so that's how we got here. And I have then over these months and over in these 15, 16 months now, gone through, you know, I go ahead to the next step and prepare, go make notes in case you're wondering. So I do work. I do prepare. And highlight particular parts. We've gotten to part three, in putting this book together back in 2003, which was, I think I did most of the writing in 2003. You know, it seemed like it would be nice to sort of divide up the steps into these three parts. And that's, it's kind of a writer just for you, you know, people who are interested in these things. It's kind of a writer trick is to like divide up books into parts. And it's almost a way of making the reader feel like, oh, there's some logic to this. And it is, I think, largely for the reader. Depends. Some books, it's really necessary. But it was a way of helping me and helping readers think about the different areas of the steps. So part one I called Surrender for step one, step two, and step three. So the idea that we were first surrendering to our addiction and then surrendering to a higher power and then having to sort all that out, what that would mean. And then part two was called Investigation and Responsibility, steps four through nine. It's pretty evident what that's about. And I think probably many people think of the steps in these three different sections. Certainly when you move from step three to step four, there's some big change happening in the steps. And step four and step five are obviously connected, but step four is also connected to step nine because you're writing down your inventory that then you're going to have to make amends about. So there's a clear through line from step four to step nine. And then step 10, because it is reiterating essentially steps four through nine, is clearly, you know, another big shift. It's like it's about continuing to take inventory and admitting it when you're wrong. So that's specifically steps 4 and step 9 are in that step, but it implies this whole ongoing process, which clearly it's pointing us in another direction with the steps, because up to here, there's been this process by which we could say, oh, I'm working the steps. And you can sort of like the first time you go through these things and you are uncovering things for the first time and making amends for the first time and taking this inventory for the first time. And so there's this whole process, which, you know, is considered certainly by the founders and traditional AA to be an essential part of recovery. But once you've done that once, you know, the question is, well, okay, am I done with that? And, you know, you are done with it. Well, everybody's got their view about this, but, you know, I would say you're done with this as a sort of groundwork and as a, the seeing the primary issues that you've had to deal with and sort of sorting all that out and getting your life on track. And now step 10 is saying, yes, and you need to keep it on track. And here's the beginning of how you're going to do that. So step 10 is the maintenance of the inventory. And then step 11 is this deepening spiritual element, which kind of somewhat calls to mind step 3. And we'll get to that when we get there. And then step 12, this sort of culminating step has multiple layers, but has three kind of primary layers to it. But as it's the last line in step 12 says, to practice these principles in all our affairs, it calls back what I began talking about, which is that the idea that our lives should be guided by principles now rather than like impulses, you know, or cravings, you know, and that you know, I mean, in a way, you know, when you get to that point, maybe that's the most important thing we have to keep in mind. In our recovery, maybe the thing that's most important in sustaining recovery and sustaining a life that's you know, potentially happy, joyous, and free, that we continue, that we practice these principles in all our affairs. So that's kind of a summation of where we are going in the coming months, because I assume that it's going to take us some months to get through these last three steps. And then we will have to figure out where to go from there. What we could do is just run the recordings of the talk. So I just go back to, and then I could really take a break. Anyway, always trying to figure out ways to make it easier. So here we are at, I'm on page, doesn't have a page number on it. Let's see, page 204 says part 3, fulfillment. So, you know, it's sort of interesting that when I think of the last three steps, I think of them as the maintenance steps. And I mentioned that in here, but, I think I was trying to give a little bit more of an uplifting sort of characterization of the last three steps. And it is a nice, I do like that fulfillment. Maintenance just sort of sounds like a drag, you know, like just have to go out and mow the lawn and rake the leaves and brush your teeth and don't forget to floss, and, you know, maintain. Whereas fulfillment sounds like, well, fulfillment also sounds like you've arrived somewhere, which is not really true, but makes people feel good. So I have, as I do for each of these parts of the book, I have a short introduction here. I might as well read it. It's just three short paragraphs. The last three steps are the culmination of the spiritual path. Here we try to thoroughly integrate the work we've done into our lives. We learn to maintain the honesty and responsibility we developed in the earlier steps to deepen our spiritual connection and to serve others. Buddhism teaches that the real value of the spiritual life isn't found in moments of great bliss, but in the daily application of mindfulness and loving kindness. Steps 10, 11, and 12 point to the same truth. It's our ongoing effort that is most important to our spiritual development. We can't rest on yesterday's calm and insight. We must renew our commitment and energy each day. These steps are the cornerstones of maintenance. They are also the bridge to a life that is, quote, happy, joyous, and free, unquote. Our spiritual awakening brings liberation as we enter a new life, one free from the encumbrances of addiction, and one guided by the principles of wisdom and compassion. I've been writing Dharma books for too long, so... So the phrase that I highlighted on this page, actually, I'm going to ask, here's a test, how much people know me and how much, maybe, I don't know, that's not even fair, but what sentence do you think I highlighted in this? And I don't know, maybe some of you don't have the book in front of you. How many people have the book in front of you? Okay, yeah, that's pretty good. That's excellent. So, and Debbie's got the original version, the classic version, which I actually prefer that cover. But anyway, so give me some guesses here. Which sentence did I highlight? I should be nicer. I should say, what sentence would you highlight? Not trying to make this a competition. Carol, what do you have to say?
I think it's going to be, we can't rest on yesterday's calm and insight. We must renew our commitment and energy each day.
That's nice. Good line.
For me, that's
yeah.
Key.
Yeah, definitely. It's worth highlighting. Yes. But yeah, thank you. First sentence of the second paragraph. Who said that? Catherine? Yes. That actually is the one that I highlighted, which is Buddhism teaches that the real value of the spiritual life isn't found in great moments of great bliss, but in the daily application of mindfulness and loving kindness. And it, of course, it goes exactly along with the last sentence that Carol highlighted. I highlighted that, I think, partly, you know, because the note that I made about this was, it challenges the idea of light enlightenment as an endpoint or great insights. And then in parentheses, like on plant medicine. So it might be a theme that I have running on right now. You know, moments of great bliss are, you know, lots of fun. But anyway, yeah, this is definitely right where, I'm sorry, I'll use the cliche, the rubber meets the road, and this is really, you know, my work much more than, as people come to me, like, you know, who are trying to get sober or trying to stay sober, and or they're worried about their family member that's an addict and what should they do, and that's not, I don't consider that to be my work. Not that I don't want to do it. It's just not something I have the gift for. What I consider my work to be the work of, renewing our commitment and energy each day. and the daily application of mindfulness and loving kindness, and which is meant to address the fact that life goes on. You know, you work the steps and then life goes on, and that there, you know, that getting through the first 6 months of the first year is just one issue. And as I say, it's not the one that I feel like I can really solve for people as much as the question of how to maintain this, how to keep going. And, we want to think. That's why I like this idea of enlightenment or something, or I had a great insight. We want to think that something has been solved when we have those moments. And, you know, my point is that nothing is ever solved, you know, all solutions are temporary. Yeah, there are solutions, but they are only the solutions to something that's in the past. And now the present and the future keeps unfolding. And the question is how to live with all that, and how to maintain some balance and sanity and happiness through all the things that keep happening, you know, and when all of a sudden you can't leave your house, you know, and people are dying, and you know, everything that you depended on as a routine is taken away, and everything else that happens in life, whether it's, you know, sickness, old age, and death, or jobs, or relationships, or children, or parents, and you know, it just doesn't stop, right? And so how do we deal with that? And it's this daily work. It's this constantly coming back. And that, you know, the practice of meditation, besides being a tool in itself, is also a metaphor for life. And it's the metaphor for this path, and it's encapsulated in that phrase, keep coming back, which happens to be also a phrase that's often said at the end of every 12-step meeting. Often said at the end of every, I've heard it at the end of every meeting. So what that means to me is that we're coming back to these principles that guide us. You know, we meditate and the mind wanders, and we come back to the breath. Well, if we take the breath as being the guiding principle, or the through line, or the intention, the right intention that's guiding us, then that's the thing we come back to. It's the principles, practicing these principles in all our affairs. And the mind wandering is life. Life wanders, you know, and it goes into fantasies and resentments and fears and, you know, just calculations. I don't know how much time people spend calculating, but it's something that I notice in my own meditation. There's plenty of calculating, and I don't often hear meditation teachers talk about that. It's usually talking about thoughts, but calculating is one of those, like, ways that we just keep the mind busy, you know, thinking about numbers and dates and money and how many years it was since, anyway. So all those mental ramblings are the in this metaphor are like the problems that arise in life. And then realizing, okay, what, I come back to my breath, and I come back to my body, and I go, oh, you know, where am I really, and where am I trying to go really, and what should I do, you know, what can I call upon to do? And of course, that that coming back, then coming back to the breath, is also then the metaphor for coming back to the Eightfold Path, and which means it's coming, it's the refuge. It's the refuge in the breath is the refuge in the Dharma, saying, oh, what's my foundation? What can I trust here? What do I need to be reminded of? You know, which the word sati, which is the Pali word from which we have decided that we translate as mindfulness, the word sati has its roots in a word that's about memory. And there's a lot of different opinions about what that means. And, you know, scholars who say, well, it means this. And I have my own understanding of that, which for me, what's really important about that is remembering what is true, remembering the Dharma, remembering to be present. It's not about remembering the past, because remembering is also about remembering what is real, and which, you know, means that the wandering mind, you know, gets lost in an unreality, in a dream. You know, there's a great term on one of the sort of stages of insight, those stages of awakening, is called disenchantment, when we are no longer under the spell of our delusion, under the spell of our wandering mind, you know, our conditioned beliefs and conditioned responses, that we are actually, the spell is broken and we see reality. And so, you know, when we meditate, we have those moments of disenchantment over and over, snapping out of it. Oh, wow. There I go. I was in that dream. I was in that fantasy. I was in that enchanted forest, you know. Wasn't it lovely? Oh, yeah. Oops, it wasn't real. So a few reflections for a Tuesday morning in July of 2021, according to the calendar that was created by some Romans, I believe, some thousands of years ago. Also, I believe the Dalai Lama's birthday, is it today? July 6th. I saw him on Twitter, you know, he was tweeting out. All right, that was your cue. Yeah, hey, Jim, hi.
Good morning. Happy birthday, Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
Let's see. So what was the term you used? Calculating?
Yeah.
I was just thinking about that as it's also, for me at least, a way of maintaining the illusion that I'm in control of things. And that there's a self that yes. is in control of things as well.
That's right.
So yeah. I do think that is really, that's really worth paying attention to.
Yeah.
Secondly, you were very convincing. I bought the book on Kindle. And I have a question. Who's the guy in the picture?
You know, that's one of those, like,
oh, it's a stock picture?
Stock shot, yep. Okay. I know that people are always like, wow, is that you? Like,
is that you?
I don't remember being there. I think, they took my picture out of this book altogether, didn't they? I just realized that. Wow, no picture of me. Sad. Go on.
Okay, so I'm on an Amazon roll here.
Right.
So thirdly, fulfillment, it was, you wrote before there were Amazon fulfillment centers, I guess. That's what I think of when I think of fulfillment now.
Yeah.
Amazon fulfillment centers. And fourth, I noticed when I was buying the book that your Daily Reflections book is on Kindle Unlimited now. Do you know that? Did you know that?
I don't. What is that?
It means you can read it for free if you're a Kindle. Oh, no. I guess it's a subscription thing. There's Prime Reading and there's Kindle Unlimited. That's you pay a monthly service and you can read it for free or read a bunch of books.
I think I signed up for that probably. I just figured, you know, get it out there. And,
okay. You know. That was what I was wondering. Do they ask you or do they?
Yeah. Because I published it through Amazon, I get directly paid by Amazon, and they have this thing. If you're going to take me down this route, you know, you asked for it. They have a thing called KENP, which is Kindle Edition Normalized Pages. It's the number of pages read by Kindle Unlimited and Kindle Owners Lending Library readers that qualify for a share of the KDP Select Global Fund. So since the 1st of July, people have read 1,528 pages of Daily Reflections through that. You got me going there, Jim. And
I apologize.
If I've made a nickel from that, I would be surprised. So it's pretty much like being on Spotify, you know, you just give yourself away. Give it away, give it away, give it away.
So I bought the book, downloaded it to my iPad, but it's through the Kindle process at Amazon. So in other words, every page I read in the book, you're getting a royalty for. They're tracking the pages that I read. I bet you they are.
Probably.
Anyway, I feel really good about that.
I can tell you that I make more money when you buy the actual book.
When you buy a hard copy?
Or if you buy the Kindle version.
Which I did.
Oh, okay. Then we're good. We're good then.
Okay. So there's my Dana for the day.
Oh, okay. Darn. Debbie, did you want to say something like Dharma related?
There you go. It's going to bring it on back.
Wow, keep coming that. Back.
All of this. Exactly. I love that. You know, when you were asking about, you know, what sentence would we anticipate you might have highlighted.
Yeah.
And then thank you for offering which one, you know, or maybe which one did you highlight? And myself, and I have highlighted the last sentence, that last paragraph, you know, a bridge to happy, joyous, and free. And our spiritual awakening brings liberation as we enter a new life, when free of encumbrances of addiction and when guided by the principles of wisdom and compassion. And I have to say, there is such a freedom. By the time you get to step 10, it's like, oh, I get to stay on top of this now every day. Step 10, I'm not drowning in all of that past, at least not so much. I might not have completed, you know, do we ever complete for, you know, 5, 8, 9? Do we ever? We don't, but we get ourselves at least so that our head is above water. Eventually. And then step 10 offers that respite of it's not lackadaisical, not working, but it's so much easier to, you know, wipe the counter clean when there's not an inch of dust on it, you know, so it's more manageable. And so for me, that relates to coming back into the present moment and knowing that I don't have to do anything, work with anything else but that right now. I don't have to worry about the future. I've done my best about the past. And as the past comes up in the present moment, then I can deal with it again right now. And so I'm ever so grateful for that and for experiencing that in my life.
I can offer that possibility to my sponsees. I have one sponsee who's still drowning right now. And I'm just so, I have so much compassion for her because I know that, I know where that is, you know, I know that that place. And yeah, getting to step 10 is a wonderful thing. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Debbie. That's great. Appreciate it. Megan, you wanted to chime in?
Hi. Hi, Kevin. Hi, hi everyone. So it's interesting talking about the past. You know, I'm a therapist, and a lot of sometimes what we do is talk about the past and integrate past experiences, which I think is maybe what steps 4 through 9 are a little bit about, is that integration process of healing in a way. Anyway, I'm up here on Bainbridge Island, and I'm looking at old pictures of myself as a kid. I found a bunch of pictures from the early 80s, and looking at this little kid, you know, I have cystic fibrosis. I don't know if I've ever mentioned that, but I was, you know, at that time, most kids with cystic fibrosis didn't live past a certain age, you know, they didn't have, anyway. So, and then I started looking at my teenage years when I started using and drinking, and the change that happened in me. It's like that innocence, really, the innocence, the playfulness, the child, you know, just got stampeded with, I don't know, drugs and alcohol and being a badass and confidence, and that this fake confidence that I had. And I guess in my sobriety, you know, just now, you know, I'm reflecting on that younger part, that playful part, which I think is more presence, right? Our child, our inner child, our child is present usually, yeah. You know? And so I guess I'm thinking of integrating that younger version of me, you know, and seeing the change that happened and coming back to that now. I don't really know much what to say about more to say, but.
No, I think that I really appreciate that, Megan, because it's definitely something I've thought about quite a bit. And, you know, I think of it as like this return to innocence and realizing that, like, many of us in our childhood did have some sort of guiding, whether we call it spiritual or, but sort of some path. And there was some, we can, when we look back and we realize, oh, we really lost our way. And typically it's in our teenage years that starts to happen. And I do think that part of recovery can be this kind of going back to where, particularly in the kind of finding joy, like where was my joy as a child, you know, that I lost, that I tried to replace with drugs and alcohol. So, but it also can be painful to look at that, but to try to turn that into a positive or something valuable as we, you know, as we go on in our recovery. Yeah. Thank you. Joe, why don't you have the last word here?
The last word, my gosh.
Well, I'll actually have the last word, but you know.
Oh, good.
So don't worry. No pressure.
You know, Kevin, I was thinking about Zen mind, beginner's mind. And it's interesting because in the foreword by Houston Smith to that book, there in the original edition, I don't know. there's a discussion of the fact that that Shinro Suzuki never speaks of in light of Satori, right? In the experience, and I really, really like that because it's all just returning to the practice over and over again. And in fact, when I think back to my ACA days, you know, I could almost swear that there was some sort of line in the stuff that we used to read that talked about giving up this idea of ever getting there or, you know, being willing to give up exciting experiences or something. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with excitement, but, okay. But seeking excitement, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah. Thanks, Joe. That's a good way to sum up this morning, I mean, if you're enlightened, why do you have to talk about it? Like, seems like probably like, you know, not necessary. The seeking excitement, it's like that. I think as addicts, that's like the guiding principle, the guiding light of like where you want to be is like high, you know, we want to stay high all the time. And rather than saying, oh, those moments come, you know, and they're delightful and to be enjoyed and then let go of. Well, thank you all. Just a few programming notes. This evening, I will be giving a talk to Napa Valley Insight Group, and this will be part of my series on the Eightfold Path. And tonight, the topic is right mindfulness, which is, you know, I actually rarely give a talk on just mindfulness. So we'll see what that's like. And then this Friday will be the Spirit Rock Zoom class rather than the Kevin Zoom. You can get there. I have the link on the same Zoom page on my website. Thank you for all your Donna and your presence and hanging out with me, helping me to get through these times. Very much appreciate having a community where I feel safe to be me, which is not true of every place in the world. So thanks.